Welcome to We Fly the Flag, the Air Canada Pilots Podcast. Well, hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Jason Chamberlain. In this episode, I'm talking with Joel Hodderick. He is Labor Relations Counsel in the Representation Department for ALPA National. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you very much. I am flattered to have been asked to come and speak to the pilots this morning, and very excited to spend the next little while with you talking about, hopefully, all things legal.
Well, absolutely. Well, this episode will focus on the legalities surrounding collective bargaining in Canada. We'll touch on the foundation of the Canada Labour Code, specifically Section 48 and Section 50, and we'll talk about the role of representation at the negotiations table, and we'll explore the current political climate and how it affects collective bargaining in 2024. So, Joel, let's talk. Thanks for being here. It's always interesting to learn a little bit about the podcast guests and more specifically their background. So how did you wind up being Labor Relations Counsel with a national pilot union?
Well, I think if you had met high school Joel, you would have known that I had two aspirations coming out of high school. One was to be an airline pilot, and the second one was to be a lawyer. And I started university. And then started my flight training in 1990-1991, which was the back end of the last great recession of the 1990s. So I doubled down on my efforts, went through, finished my post-secondary education, and that eventually led to my pursuit of a combined MBA and law degree. And I spent 15 years working in the oil and gas sector as a professional negotiator with several large oil companies in the city. Concurrent with that, of course, I had an interest in aviation, owned several light aircraft, taught part-time, and was always sort of interested in it. Got to a point in my career in 2016, where I had a boss I wasn't too keen on, and decided that maybe I'd give this flying thing a full-time lick, and so left my job as a corporate lawyer and started ground school at WestJet Encore on April the 3rd. So my first full-time flying job was as first officer on a Q400. I worked at Encore for 2 years up until January of 2019, and then crossed the field and went to work at Air Transat, where I flew the 330 and the 321 overseas for about a year and a half until the pandemic put an end to that aviation nonsense. And I returned to the legal career. I joined ALPA in 2022. It seems like it's been forever, but it hasn't really. I'm only coming up on my second full year anniversary with ALPA.
All right, so aviation and legal. I can see a passion for both things in your life there. All right, well, I'm just going to get straight into it here, Joel. Why do we need representation at the negotiating table? And if you don't mind me asking this, is the representation that one trade union uses the same as the next? For example, QP versus UFCW versus ALPA?
I think, at a very high level, as a lawyer, you're trained to think in terms of how do I articulate a problem or a solution to a problem, and how do I write it in a way that is, transparently or commonly understood. I think, we should talk a little bit about the differences between the two, QP and the Food and Commercial Workers Union, which you referred to, and then ALPA, because I think they live in sort of two different mindsets or two different environments. A traditional trade union would have very much a staff orientation. The staff would come in and direct the operation of the union, whereas ALPA is very much pilot-led and staff-supported. And that's, I think one of the fundamental differences between ALPA and some of the other unions that you mentioned. So in this case, your pilots, your fellow peers, are going to be your negotiators. They're going to be your leadership. They're going to develop the strategy and the tactics that are going to be used at the bargaining table. My role and responsibility as a lawyer, were I to be advising Air Canada, and I'm not at the table with Air Canada. You have quite a capable cadre of your own professionals who are there, doing that work. Their role is to advise, to help help ensure that the documents that are being created are structured properly, that they anticipate some potential problems or pitfalls. And we really spend a lot of time and intellectual effort to ensure that there's really no ambiguities. The last thing you want is a contract that nobody really understands what it means and that doesn't, create a crystallized understanding of what the deal really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and pilots and their respective airlines are largely governed by, Canadian aviation regulations. And second to that, they fly to their company and aircraft operating procedures and manuals. And then they also fly within their respective collective agreements as well. So the framework that pilots operate within, I think it's fair to say, are more complex and critical than the average trade union's collective agreement, would you say?
Absolutely. You have to understand the rules. And really, the contract becomes the rule book. The metaphor or the explanation that I give to management when I'm sitting down trying to negotiate specific terms is, look, there's very little prospect that a pilot's going to crack open the cars at 3 o'clock in the morning sitting in an overnight in Thunder Bay or St. John's or London or wherever it is that that individual happens to be. But they are going to open the collective agreement. They're going to take a look at the relevant section that pertains to the problem or the question that they have, and they're going to try and understand what are the rules that apply in this particular circumstance and how do I govern myself and what is fair for me to do, what is fair for the company to do. And as long as that is communicated effectively in the written word, I think we've been successful in terms of rendering that down, those concepts or those agreements down into something that everybody can follow.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's look at landscape. So the working landscape has changed dramatically in the past 10 years, especially in aviation. And I don't think it really matters if you're looking at someone's personal life or professional life. If nothing changes, improves, evolves over 10 years, it's going to create a feeling of dissatisfaction and a desire for change. So, welcome to the career of an Air Canada pilot. We've had some LOAs and MOAs that mutually benefit the company and the pilots, but overall, the Air Canada pilots are still working to an archaic framework and they're unhappy. I think they feel undervalued, overworked, and change needs to happen, and it needs to happen soon.
Well, I think if you look back over the last 10 years, so much has changed in our society. I mean, who has a 10-year-old iPhone? I don't even know if the iPhone was around 10 years ago. Maybe it was a flip phone or a BlackBerry back in the day. Technology advances, society changes, our view on, certain matters, political questions of the day evolves as time progresses, and necessarily so too does the expectations of what it means to be an individual that's working for an organization that makes them feel valued and makes them feel, appropriately compensated for the value that they bring to the organization. And I think if I'm, going to suggest an underlying theme in your negotiations is, the Air Canada pilots want to feel fully valued. They want to feel that their professionalism, their experience, their dedication to the company is being appropriately rewarded and appropriately recognized by the employer.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Yeah. Well, Joe, let's start at the top here. So Air Canada pilots were part of the transport industry. We fall under federal regulation. More specifically to what we're talking about today, Section 48 and Section 50 of the Canada Labour Code. Man, let's delve into that. Tell me about it.
Sure thing. Well, I guess let's start at the really big picture, which is the Canada Labour Code in its entirety. So that really is the rule book that governs the labour relations between those employees that work in federally regulated spheres, so telecommunications, transportation, pipelines, and so forth, banking industries, for example. And so the process by which labor groups come together and bargain with their employer in order to reach a new collective agreement really starts with the notice to bargain issued under Section 48 of the Canada Labor Code, and then the requirement to come together to meet and to bargain in good faith, which is set out in Section 50. And so that's really the part where I think your pilots are currently the regime that they're living under. So there's two parts to that. There's a requirement to come together to meet and to bargain without delay and in a good faith attempt to reach a new agreement. And good faith is, that there's a meaningful exploration, an expenditure of effort on the part of both parties to come to a reasonable solution, to come to a reasonable agreement on the new path forward. The second part of that Section 50 is that the wage rates, the working conditions will remain constant or remain static from the period of time when the last collective agreement expired, which, as I understand, took place at the end of September of 23, until a new agreement is reached or until you reach the point at which you're allowed to engage in self-help or, you know, potentially a labor action at the end of a, you know, conciliation, cooling off, and a strike notice period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do want to explore the aftermath of failed negotiations more later in the episode. But for now, it's a good summary of Section 48 and 50 of the Canada Labour Code.
Yeah, I know all your pilots have a copy of the Canada Labour Code at home under their pillow, and they sleep with it every night so that they the goodness can make its way into their brains. So,
yeah, and the collective agreement is their cuddle cushion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk EFNA, so Economic Financial Analysis Tool, something that ALPA uses. Can you tell us about that?
So you're really talking about ALPA's secret weapon. What it is a group of financial professionals that are employed directly by ALPA, and their responsibility is for analyzing the financials that are presented to them during the course of negotiation to come up with a question of what can the company really afford. Now, if you think about it, if the pilots ask for something and management says, well, we can't give that to you, we can't afford it, where do you go with that kind of a dispute? You just end up arguing and bickering back and forth about, well, yes, you can, no, you can't, and that's not a very productive path forward. So ALPA's taken the position, okay, show me. Show me what you can afford. Show me your financial statements. Let's have an understanding or look at your strategy going forward, and let's try to quantify to the extent feasible whether, in fact, what you're saying is true. Now, there may be times, for example, if a carrier is experiencing financial difficulties, they're in bankruptcy protection or something like that, where there's an analysis and the employer is asking for the employee groups to take concessions. ALPA does not give up concessions in the absence of proof and the sharing of information to legitimate whether, in fact, that should happen or not. And in this particular case, going forward, you know, you look at the robust financial health. I mean, we all see it with the financial results that get released by Air Canada on a quarterly basis. There is a robust picture here. The company is profitable. The company's making money. Load factors are up. You see it every day when you look back into the passenger cabin. You know, fully 80 to 90% of your seats are occupied. The company is doing very, very well. And that is, however, only an anecdotal analysis that you can see by, and what the ENFA colleagues do is they take those, they take the numbers and they distill them down, and say that, you know, you can afford, you know, the increase that we're asking for can be adequately absorbed by the organization.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, the EFNA department provides data to both sides, an estimation of cost and affordability. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, so they develop, in the course of negotiations, a comprehensive cost book. So, you know, as a supplier of labor, you have a cost to the organization, the salary that they pay you, any overtime that you would, the average overtime that you would garner, the cost of your benefits, the cost of your retirement to the extent that that's being funded by the employer. All of those numbers go together to create a cost exposure on an annual basis for each pilot within the organization. You add those all together, you come up with a global pilot book.
Yeah, and interestingly though, what EFNA cannot measure, and neither can Air Canada, you know, management, is the cost of a dissatisfied or undervalued employee, or in this case, pilot, times 5,200 and change. So, nor can they measure the economic benefit of a productive, happy, and rewarded pilot either. I feel like the scale of the benefits versus cost in this area is absolutely huge, right?
It's difficult to measure if you're trying to, I guess, assess it on the basis of an unquantifiable thing such as happiness. I think where happiness manifests itself is it manifests itself in terms of attrition. Are pilots leaving the organization to go elsewhere? Or in the alternative, are pilots being enticed or induced to come here because they perceive there to be some net upside to their careers by virtue of leaving whatever their current employment scenario is to come to work at you know, at Air Canada, and those trends make themselves known over the course of years and decades in terms of the ability of the employer to, you know, attract additional talent and to adequately staff you know, the ground schools and to put pilots out on the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a growing rhetoric that's echoed in Canadian media, that's, you know, there's an impending pilot shortage, which frankly in my opinion, is a cop-out that doesn't address what the actual source of that statement truly is.
ALPA would certainly say that there's not a pilot shortage, there's a pilot compensation shortage. I would use myself as an example. We talked earlier in the podcast about my background in aviation. I guarantee you, if the salary for a second-year first officer on the 330 was a couple hundred thousand dollars, I'd quit my ALPA job tomorrow and go back and hop into the right-hand seat. The reality is that's not the economic scenario that we exist in. And, you know, people always have choices. They are constantly assessing what is in my best interest as an individual and how can I do the best for my family. And for some people, that means, you know, working for a private operator, operating a biz jet. For others, that means, you know, staying in a smaller community where they can necessarily afford housing and they don't, they forego a higher salary in order to maintain a cap on their labor cost. And that may also mean, you know, honoring the dynamic that they have within their personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, moving forward, Joel, let's talk about collective bargaining and how historically it can be affected by, you know, the political climate at the time. What's the current political climate like pertaining to bargaining in 2024? Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So let's, we'll take a quick tour down history lane for a little bit. So in Canada, there was not always a constitutional protection for the right to engage in labor action or the right to strike. And really, it's only since the advent of the Federal Charter of Rights and Freedoms that we've seen in a series of five cases that have made their way to the Supreme Court that the law has really done almost a 180-degree U-turn to come from a place where there was no constitutional protection to an era where we do have constitutional protection of the right to go on strike. We talked a little bit earlier in the podcast about how things have evolved over the last 10 years. So let's look at, you know, where you were 10 years ago with the last collective agreement and where you are today in this terms of this bargaining environment. Probably the most notable decision is the Supreme Court of Canada's decision from 2016, which is the Saskatchewan healthcare workers decision. And what it talks about is that the right to engage in strike action is a constitutionally protected freedom. It's an exercise of freedom of expression rights under Section 2 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And it is something that the government you know, can only cannot interfere with. Now, of course, there are limits. You can limit that in to the extent that it's reasonably justified with within a free and democratic society. That's obviously Section 1 of the Charter. But the labor climate that we have now, if you look at some of the other labor disputes that have we've undergone over the last year or so, we have the BC Port Workers Union, very, very significant economic impact to the Canadian economy. That labor dispute was allowed to, I think they went on strike on two separate occasions over the course of about a month or so before that dispute was eventually settled. And then I'm trying to think, there was another one in Ontario. I want to say the Seaway workers. Again, you know, we're in a similar type of a situation.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and sorry to interrupt you, Joel, but it goes without saying, Federal Labor Minister O'Regan has made it quite clear in several statements to the media, he is not going to get between companies and their respective unions during the collective bargaining process.
I'm trying to remember if the exact quote, but certainly in the lead up to the dispute that we had at WestJet, I had the opportunity to meet Minister O'Regan, in person. But the government took a very hands-off approach. Now, not hands-off in the sense that they weren't interested; they were obviously very, very interested in the goings on at the table, and that there was an eventual agreement that was reached. However, there was not an overt interference on the part of the ministry. They wanted to be kept up to date. They wanted to certainly know what was going on, but they weren't. There was no unseen hand pushing down on one scale or a side of the scale or the other. And indeed, I think if you look at the fact we have a Liberal government, a Liberal minority government that is being supported as of today by the federal NDP through the Supply and Confidence Agreement. The underlying ethos of those two parties is really, one that's oriented towards labor rights and perhaps a more small L liberal view of things. I think that bodes very, very well for the current negotiating climate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I 100% agree with you on that. All right, so there are circumstances where collective bargaining doesn't conclude in a way that meets both parties' agreeable terms. You know, in this case, we get into the realm of labor action or lockout or strike territory. And at that point, it becomes basically about leverage. So let's explore the difference of the average transaction that, you know, two parties would go through versus the parties in a collective bargaining environment like this.
I would suggest that the average pilot listening to the podcast is very, very familiar with what's known as transactional bargaining, like you go and buy a car or you go and buy a house. So it's a one-off transaction where you're negotiating to specifically do one thing. I want to buy your house, and as the buyer of your house, my success is determined based on how little money I can give you and still get you to agree to sell your house to me. Now, I can engage in a number of tactics in order to get that from you at the lowest possible cost, because there's no repercussion to us not reaching an agreement other than the fact I don't get to buy your house. I'm never going to see you again. We're not going to have a relationship after the negotiation is finished. And very much the same thing applies in a car buying scenario, unless you're buying the same car every couple of years from a car dealer. The labor relations relationship is fundamentally different, and it's more like a marriage necessarily than it is like the two examples that I've given you with respect to buying a house or buying a car. It is a marriage where divorce is not one of the available options. You, unless you're prepared to quit and go and work somewhere else, are going to be involved in a relationship with your employer for 20, 30, you know, potentially 40 years if you're there and you start young enough. And as a result, the relationship is one that, you know, you'll always be negotiating another contract a few years down the line and necessarily coming back together again at the bargaining table. So it's important to understand that how you determine success, and this may seem like a little bit of a cliche, but the way I ask people to consider it is the best deal is one where both sides necessarily go away a little bit unhappy. In the case of labor, that I accepted a little bit less than what I think I was ultimately entitled to, and in the case of management, that we ultimately paid more than what it is that we thought we should at the end of the day. And to the extent that you have that equilibrium and that mutual dissatisfaction, that is generally, in my mind, indicative of a good deal. Mm. Now, if one side feels that they have absolutely, you know, handed it to the other side and it, with a smashing victory, that creates a situation of disequilibrium and is a situation where the other side is going to feel that in the next bargaining cycle, they want to get... they want to claw that advantage back and they want to get their own type of a win. And so they'll be looking to even the score. And that sets up that spiral of bad blood that necessarily goes back and forth. And I think that maybe it typifies the circumstances where your pilots currently are. I think there's a high level of frustration with the employer. There's a perception that you've been mired in a contract that has been in existence for, you know, upwards of 10 years. The language has not kept pace with changes in the overall economy and in changes in the industry. And some of the successes that have been enjoyed by some of your other labor groups. And there's very much a desire on the part of the pilots to want to even the score. And so the challenge that exists for your negotiators is how best to meet the expectations of your pilot groups within the confines of the ability to get a deal with the employer. So let's talk about generating leverage. So leverage is basically, how do I garner an advantage over my counterpart in order to get what I want at the end of the day? In simplest terms, as labor, you sell your time and your availability to the employer, who then utilizes you for the production of their service, which is flying airplanes across the world. The employer, for its part, compensates you and pays you. So from labor, the only thing you can really do is to withdraw your labor from the employer and deprive them of that input so they can't operate their business. And then the alternative, or on the other side of the fence, you have the employer who cannot pay you. They basically say, go home and stay home and until we can reach some sort of an agreement. And that's, we're really talking about two sides of the same coin. Yeah. From the labor perspective, it's a strike. And from the management perspective, it's a lockout. What do they fundamentally mean? Essentially, they mean the same thing. The entity, the airline, is not operating. It's not flying flights. It's not generating revenue. And the business will necessarily, is temporarily interrupted until there's an agreement with respect to the supply of labor by the labor component at a price that management is prepared to pay. Now, it's important to note, we always look at things in terms of absolutes. So from a strike perspective, it means I'm not going to work today. We've got our picket signs. Nobody's going to cross the picket line and the airline is shut down. From the management's perspective, a lockout means we've shut the airline. Nobody's coming to work today. We're not paying anybody to operate the flights. And we're going to basically try and wait the union out until eventually they decide that they need a paycheck and they want to come back to work and they capitulate and we restore activities. But it's important to note that there's several stops that you can reach, excuse me, along that pathway. So strike doesn't necessarily mean a total cessation of the supply of labor. It can mean, for example, when legally permitted, following the rules of the contract to the black letter, not picking up additional overtime. Again, I must stress, only when that's legally permitted, and that would be in a scenario once there's been a strike authorization. Or, for example, taxiing at a very, very low speed that's, consistent with safety. Perhaps you want to drop the gear and flaps 20 miles final and drag the airplane in, and be fully configured at from 10,000 feet down. These are all things that the labor group can engage in to basically pressure the employer through additional costs and reduced efficiencies to make the employer capitulate to the demands that are being raised by labor. Again, I must stress, only when that's legally permitted, and that would be in a scenario once there's been a strike authorization. In the alternative, management can do things such as canceling vacation allotments. They can just pay out vacation time. They can discontinue health and dental benefits. So you can't take your kid and have the braces put on during the course of, during a certain period of time. And so lockout in that scenario doesn't necessarily mean that there will be nobody going to work. They may just be going to work under a different set of working rules once that change is legally permitted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't have any doubts of the resolve of the Air Canada pilots. As you alluded to earlier, I think it's fair to say that we are extremely frustrated with this outdated framework. It's unfortunate that on both sides of the fence, these tools, ultimately, they're not good for the company, for the pilots, at least in the short term. And most importantly, they're not good for the traveling public, our customers. But at the same time, that is the nature of leverage.
I have yet to meet a pilot that was not 100% vested in the economic success of their employer. I mean, everybody wears the uniform proudly. You go to work, you provide the best customer service, the best operational experience possible to your passengers, because you realize that the airline industry is competitive and you're trying to keep the passengers that you have and entice new passengers to come and work with you. Not going to work, not getting them where they want to go, is not part of the script when it comes to providing excellent customer service. However, as the dispute advances and lack of progress is being made at the bargaining table, you're going to want to apply additional pressure to the employer. And you do that by basically introducing the element of doubt into the customer base. And what you're attempting to do is to create a scenario where there's bookaways. So for example, if somebody's considering, am I going to be buying a ticket for my annual vacation to Europe this summer? I want to go in late August. Do I book with Air Canada? Or because there's this labor disruption or the potential of a labor disruption in the offing, do I book with one of the competitors and thereby take away some of the ambiguity or the uncertainty associated with my ability to travel? Now, if enough people do that over a very, very large number of passengers, you have an overall decline in revenue. And of course, airlines are heavily dependent on forward booking, forward sales, in order to create and maintain a robust schedule going forward. And cash flow is really the one of the primary drivers. Now, taken to its theoretical maximum, the closer you get to a disruption, the louder the potential of a disruption gets, the more pressure and the more leverage is created in that type of a bargaining scenario. That will eventually reach a climax. And I would suggest to you that the point of climax is 11:59, the day that a strike action is supposed to be commenced. Because if you think about it, once you cross the threshold and once you engage in the labor disruption itself, you've crested the hill already and you're now on the backside. You've taken the ambiguity and you've converted it into reality. Now you know that the people on that particular day aren't going to be going flying, that you won't be generating revenue from those tickets. And there may, in fact, be a scenario where you have to refund those ticket prices. And so there's a cost to the employer, a direct out-of-pocket cost to the employer that is measurable and that they can point their they can point their finger at. And certainly, too, for the pilots, you're not getting paid that day. And so there's a direct cost to you as an individual. And, you know, 1 month's salary is 8.75% of your annual take-home income. So if you think about it, you know, if you're off work for a month, you're going to have to get at least an 8.75% raise for your first year just to offset the money you've lost by not being able to go to work for a month.
Yeah. Joel, the company does not appear to be engaging quickly at the table, given the few agreements that have been reached to date. You know, the pilots union and the company have both agreed to have a mediator sit at the table. Is there an advantage for not moving quickly here?
Well, I think in the current environment, they don't have to give you a raise. They're paying the last rate increase that you received as a result of your stale contract that's now, I think, fully 9 years, 9 years old. And so essentially, they maintain a cap or a lid on their cost, at least the labor component cost as it pertains to the pilots, for as long as they can continue to drag out that process. And they also now, you know, kick the potential increase that they're going to have to give to you into the indefinite future for as long as they possibly can. So it's rational, I think, economic behavior on the part of the employer when you don't factor in, and we talked about intangible costs before, the dissatisfaction or the unhappiness of the pilot group, and how, you know, economically do you quantify that dissatisfaction?
Yeah. I mean, I know I can speak for several pilots who I've sat in the flight deck with over several days of a pairing, over much discussion. You know, we share the same view. Like, if the company wants to drag their feet in an attempt to save themselves money and delay the onset of a new contract, I'm sorry, but if a new TA comes out without back pay, it's a no for me. You know, that clause needs to be in there. It's becoming about principle now.
Well, and I certainly understand the perspective. You feel like you've foregone a raise. You have made less money this year than you would have under circumstances where you were able to reach an agreement in a timely fashion. Now, the one cautionary note that I would raise is, make sure you judge the deal based on the overall comprehensive economics of the deal. I really would suggest that you have to take a good hard look at the global economics. You have to look at what do you gain in the totality, rather than create singular points that are going to condemn a deal because you didn't get this or you didn't get that. And unfortunately, we talk about it in joking fashion when I negotiate and talk with some of the pilots south of the border. Everybody wants a pony. But sometimes you don't always get a pony.
Yeah, I do hear you, Joel. You know, ultimately, a yes or a no vote when the time comes is a very individual decision for each pilot and his family to make. But if the average Air Canada pilot feels like the company dragged this process out longer than it needed to be, then the cost of something like a back pay clause, you know, they're going to feel like that shouldn't be part of the overall cost of the contract.
We talked about economics and financial analysis much earlier in the podcast. Ultimately, the contract has a cost, whether it's a contract for 2 years or 5 years or 4 years or whatever the term is. The sum total of what every pilot gets paid, all of their benefits and their retirement entitlements, everything goes into a global spreadsheet, and that comes up with a number. And I would suggest for the Air Canada pilots, that's a pretty big number. There's a pretty big number today, and there is an even greater number in the future with what the future cost is necessarily going to be. Now, money isn't created in a vacuum. It doesn't, to use the cliche, does not grow on trees. Mm. So the cost portion that is allocated towards back pay could just as easily be shifted to additional rates going forward. And I think that's something that, again, why you want to look at the deal globally and in its totality, because ultimately higher rates invariably is the gift that keeps on giving in future. You will always get the benefit of those additional rates going forward in perpetuity, even assuming that you had flatline pay for the next 10 years, because you're getting more and you will garner that rate of return. Whereas a one-time payment, for example, a signing bonus or something that's retroactive back only for a few months. It's just shifting money around within the same spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, let's change gears a little bit here. I want to get into contract language ambiguity. Now, this is something that Air Canada pilots have been dealing with for a decade, and it affects every aspect of their working life. And sometimes it affects when they can be home and when they can't. So it basically affects their home life as well. Why does language ambiguity usually favor the company?
It comes down to the problem that exists with imprecise language and failing to express in the requisite level of detail with the requisite level of precision the concepts that were agreed to at the table. I mean, if you think about it, a deal between two friends, you can very easily, with a handshake or on the back of a napkin, agree to a very, very simple business transaction. And that never becomes a problem so long as both parties do act and honor the commitments that they've made to one another. And there's no dispute as to whether that was in fact happened or not. However, that's highly dependent not only on the relationship between those two individuals, but also on the continuity of those two individuals. As soon as you introduce another person into that who wasn't there during the context of the negotiations, they lose the context or they lose the background and the understanding of what was actually agreed to. And that's where you have to go back to the written language in the contract. And this becomes the constant battle or the constant challenge that exists with the grievance and arbitration process. What did the parties do what is written on the page and honor the obligation and the commitment that they made to one another when there's a constant revolving door, not only in terms of negotiators, but also grievance committee members, pilots come in and look at and read different things differently, management comes in and reads things necessarily differently. And I think where the situation that you're talking about, where those ambiguities are resolved to the disadvantage of labor, it's because you have one individual that is trying to push against a larger organization that's developed a series of rules or policies to implement contract language in a way. And they're really at a disadvantage because it becomes the David versus Goliath type of a scenario.
Yeah, absolutely does. And that's why we need clear and concise language in our contract moving forward. Well, we're almost out of time for this episode, Joel. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up?
Well, I guess, I mean, I'd like to soapbox a little bit for the ALPA process. I know that the Air Canada pilots, have recently joined ALPA. You've been involved with the organization basically for less than a year since you all voted to join us. We're delighted to have you, by the way. It's great. I think this is one of the best moves, not only for ALPA as an organization to welcome you on board, but also to have you guys here. Understand the process. Interact with your MEC. Provide constant feedback. Participate in the polling. Participate in the surveys. Make your voice heard. It is only as a result of being able to have the silent majority come forward and speak. The people that want to make a point and want to climb up on top of the soapbox are always going to be heard, right? Because they're going to be yelling from the top of the ramparts. It's the people that go, you know what, I'm okay with this, I'm not okay with this. That's the people we have a difficult time really reaching. Those are the difficult, and those are the people that we need to see at pilot unity building events, that we need to see in polling, that need to come to LEC meetings on a regular basis and make their voices heard. Because it's only as a result of the unity and the larger group, and I've seen it work time and time and time again, that the group overall will be successful. And I should add one more thing. Appreciate that everybody has an unspoken partner in their contract, whether it's your spouse, your significant other, if you're single, your family support structure, your friend group. There are people that depend on you, that interact with you on a day-to-day basis, that form part of your support structure, and those people are coming along with you. They will ride this rail and this journey all the way through to the end, come what may. And so insofar as you interact with your fellow peers, don't just fall into the echo chamber and hang out with a bunch of pilots. You know, make sure that your spouse and your children come to family unity building events, and that you feel that sense of community, because it's only through the diversity of what that community represents that you'll be able to be successful in what has to come in the future.
Mm, yeah, that's really well said, Joel. I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. Well, thank you, Joel, for being here and for sharing your knowledge with the Air Canada Pilots podcast. It's very much appreciated. And to the listeners, keep the conversation going. Keep an eye on your ALPA email for updates and, of course, for new surveys. Be sure to show your support by wearing your ALPA lanyard. And as always, fly safe.
Air Canada 101, got that converter 1280.
Go ahead, you have an idea.
111. Here's one. Going around for a